Welcome to the Waking Up Human podcast. I am your host, Mandy Trapp, and in this episode, I'm going to dive deep into the often avoided conversation of middle age and what the spiritual perspective is on the big midlife crisis. After recently celebrating the arrival into my mid-40s, I found myself beginning to cross that bridge where I am definitely old enough to know who I am not, but still too young to know entirely who I am. And of course, the real reason why I'm here. The great news is that after what feels like a lifetime of collecting pieces, I finally feel that I have, well, at least close to it, the full puzzle, and I'm excited to begin to put it together with all of you here now. Stay tuned for a soulful, stirring, mind-opening look into the real crisis of midlife and the incredible gift that is just waiting for all of us to open. Hey there, and welcome back to the Waking Up Human podcast. I am your host, Mandy Trapp, and I just turned 44 years old. Now, why does it matter that I'm sharing my age with you right now? Well, because it all matters based on this podcast here right now. So it wasn't necessarily the topic that I had planned to share with you, but as you know, I love to speak to whatever it is that is present and sitting in the field, especially with you, my listeners. Now, I just turned 44 last weekend and had, I'm going to call it as a mid-40s type woman, a few very horrifying experiences this week. And I had three separate people ask me if, oh my God, did you just turn 50? Congratulations. Now, you can imagine the look of horror on my face when I would turn to all three of these people and say, what? Do I actually look like I just turned 50? And I know, I get it. There is nothing that is more embarrassing and sometimes a little shocking than feeling like you've put your foot in your mouth and you have to dig it out after you've said that. But it actually threw me into a bit of a tailspin, because I think that especially as women, we have these ideas around what every single age should look like, maybe where we should be, where we shouldn't be at that time. And when I say tailspin, it definitely brought me into, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to share this experience with you. It brought me into a very humbling experience of just a couple of mornings ago, trying to prove myself that I was young and fun and fit and all of these things. So here I was in my beautiful brand new dress pants for the day. And I threw on, it's now 8:30 in the morning in Canada on a crisp fall morning. I throw on my big fluffy winter jacket and I grab my flowery roller skates that are sitting on top of my dresser. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. And so I see my husband, he's on a Zoom call on the other side of the house, and he kind of watches me, you know, as I carry these skates towards the front door. The kids had already left for school. And I put these skates on and carefully open up the door and then quietly close it behind me so as to not disturb him on a Zoom call. And I kind of sidestep down the front lawn because there's a bit of an incline and I don't necessarily want to go flying ass over tea kettle right there in front of, you know, any of my neighbors and the other passers by who are on their way to work. And just when I think that I've kind of nailed it and I've gotten myself together, I go to take my first step from the grass onto the sidewalk with these roller skates on. And there I was within about 2.5 seconds on my ass, arm all bent into 1,000 different directions underneath me. And I knew in that moment that I had broken something. And to be clear, I grew up as a highly competitive athlete and I had never broken a bone in my life. This was, in fact, my first broken bone. And of all of the bones that I could break, it was the middle finger on my right hand. So one great big F you to this experience, to this age, and to all of those who were doubting me, including myself. So figure it out, pick myself up off of the sidewalk. And just as I was dusting myself off and embarrassingly being watched by three of my neighbors standing in their front windows, I slowly begin to limp like the broken and shameful bird that I am back towards the grass. And in that moment, my husband comes running out of the house going, "Oh my God, what are you doing? What are you doing?" And the tears start streaming down my face and I can't even catch my breath. And like the incredible prince that he is, he scoops me up, carries me into the house. And he said, "What did you think that you were doing?" And I said, "I was just trying to make myself happy. Just trying to make myself happy." And in the back of my head, it was like, I feel as though I had so much that I needed to prove to myself in that. And I failed. And I failed. And so humbling of an experience and of a response from my husband when he said, "Mandy, I think that you're meant to just really sit in and to land even longer in the truth of who you are and where you're at." And I think the tears that continued to follow then for the next half an hour or so were really the tears of that deeper question of asking myself, who am I really then and where am I? Who am I and where am I? Because I need to know, in order to know where I'm at this stage of my life, I need to know who I am. But to know who I am is I have to accept and to understand where I am and who is showing me, who is modeling this to me right now. Because when I look outside around at the world, I see 44-year-olds that are living their lives like 90-year-olds, like their life is done. They're not playing. They're not having fun. God forbid, should they try anything remotely new. And I know for me, I don't want to live my life like that. But I also see 44-year-olds who are out there trying to live their lives as though they're 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, completely throwing all sense of responsibility and wisdom to the wind and making very foolish, in my opinion anyway, decisions. And so here comes the confusion of really entering fully and completely into, and I made quite the entrance, shall I say, into what I call middle essence. Now, middle essence isn't my term. I did not come up with the idea of middle essence. In fact, this was a term that both my husband, John, and I came across, oh, maybe in the last year or so, by a wise entrepreneur, and I will call him a thought leader of our generation, this middle essence generation by the name of Chip Connelly. And Chip Connelly is the founder of something known as the Modern Elders Academy, somewhere in the Baja in Mexico. And he is a wildly successful entrepreneur who also tells an incredible story of literally crashing and burning in his life, which I think if you live long enough into your 40s and 50s and eventually reach 60, is that this is bound to happen. And it took me, I think, a long time to really recognize the gifts in all of the unwinding that comes from, well, what some people would call ultimately a midlife crisis. And maybe is this what I was going through? Is this what I am going through? Perhaps. But I think being able to navigate this midlife time right now, having had enough experience in my life, I'll say soaring at a bit of a different elevation. This is a huge gift in walking more of a spiritual path and having a spiritual understanding, is that we can actually seek the opportunities in our middle essence years. Now, let me just pause here for a moment and actually explain what middle essence is. And middle essence, according to Chip Connelly, but then, of course, with my own spin on this as well. And I think in order to understand it, we have to go back to understanding when we first felt that we were stepping into this awkward age that bridges the known and the unknown. And that would be our adolescence. Most of us, you know, when we are born, I'm going to call this phase one of our lives, is that we are born understanding who we are as an extension of our mother. And it takes until we are probably, I don't know, somewhere between the ages of 9 months and 18 months, depending on how attached you are to your mother and your mother is to you, it takes us this period of time to understand that we are, in fact, separate. And this is where we see babies, maybe your own babies, go through what we know as separation anxiety. It's that deep and stark moment of understanding, wait a second, I'm not you. And what do we experience in those moments? We experience this crisis of understanding. Well, if I'm not you, then who am I? And in the not knowing of who I am, now we start to feel all of these deep, deep, deep feelings of fear and loneliness and panic and anxiety. And then if we sit in it long enough, depression. And when we look at a lot of the psychological effects that come from separation and separation anxiety, not only as infants, but then as we begin to navigate our early adolescent years, right? Our school age years, where we now come into more full separation from the mother and potentially from the father, where we are now being thrust outside of their daily influence, their daily overreaching influence. And we are now being, I almost see this like salmon swimming upstream, fighting for belonging, fighting for connection, fighting to be seen, fighting to be heard, fighting to be relevant and understood. If we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs in this pyramid, is that ultimately what sits at the bottom in terms of our survival is everything that we need that comes from some version of mother and father. Those are the ones who feed us. Literally, they feed us. It's the food, it's the water, it's the shelter. It is what allows us to survive in that way. But then we slowly begin to make our way up this pyramid, still sitting and swimming, shall I say, in the survival arena as we enter those school-aged years. And here we are with our peers. Here we are with our teachers. Here we are trying to find and to make our way. And it's not necessarily them that we are reliant on for that bottom rung on the ladder of the food and the water and the shelter. But now we are looking for psychological survival. You know, there's a lot of different teachers beyond Maslow that really explain these in their own ways. And my teacher had shared it in terms of five very fundamental and basic needs that we have for our psychological survival. And that first need is the need for safety. And remember that this is transcendent of physical safety. This is now emotional safety. So we're experiencing a lot of this. And I'm going to say right now, especially online, communicating via social media, existing very deep into cancel culture, where people are afraid to say anything. And I recognize this even as myself, right? And I'm thinking as a micro influencer, if that's the word that you want to use. And I hate the word influencer, but I take full responsibility for the fact that my words have influence. I'm influencing not only my children, I'm influencing you and I'm influencing your children. We are always listening to the voices that have a platform, have a microphone, as I'm speaking into right now, and to those that are constantly in our ears. And so I understand this. And because of that, because of this influence that others have over us, is that we are very, very mindful around what it is that we are saying, what it is that we are sharing. And whether we take caution or not, we are extremely aware of the fact that our words can create a lack of safety in others, and their response or their feedback towards us can also create a lack of safety within ourselves. And so it immediately puts us on guard and it puts us on edge. So we definitely have that first psychological need for safety. The second psychological need for survival, of course, that we have, believe it or not, is for unconditional love. Unconditional love. Now, rewind back to your adolescence, to entering into kindergarten, into first grade, and then, of course, for the rest of your formative school-aged years. And how many of you, or maybe I should just bring this right back to you. I'm used to speaking to big groups of people, but just you, the listener right now. Have you grown up with the belief that there is something that you need to do or somebody that you need to be in order to be worthy and deserving of love? Now, just think about that for a second. I had this awareness years ago when my kids were young, and I'm going to guess somewhere around the ages of perhaps 5, 7, and 9. And we're all sitting at the dinner table one night, and I needed to rush off to go in to teach a class. And so I was in a bit of that rushing mentality, like, let's get up and clear the table. But in that very moment, one of the kids at the table had said to me, "Mom, who do you love the most? Who do you love the most?" And being the sarcastic person that I am, And also with that air of how can I get them into a competition that's going to drive them to get up, to get their butts in gear so that I can get out and get on to the next thing. And so I said, of course, you guys, I love the one the most who gets up and does all of the dishes first. My husband and I have a little chuckle to each other. But in that moment, I see three kids jump up so quickly, throw their chairs against the table, grab their plates, grab everything that they can and their tiny, sweaty little hands, and they rush past each other towards the dishwasher. And in doing so, there's fighting, there's yelling, there's hair pulling, there's scratching. I'm sure there was a bite or two that was in there. But at the very end of all of it, dishes thrown in all sorts of different directions that I know in this moment would never in a million years get anything clean. And then they all scratched their ways back towards the table. And one of them says, "Mums, you love me the most because I was the one who just finished first." And in that moment, another one of them says, "No, you didn't. No, you didn't. You only did two cups and I did all four plates." And then the last one said, "And I really wanted to do it, Mom, but I'm the littlest. And the other two wouldn't let me in. And I'm so sorry." And in that moment, looking at the looks on their faces, the anger, the sadness, the disappointment, the smiles, everything that was there right then, in what was meant to be the most innocent and, well, maybe intrinsically motivated experience coming from me. I was hoping for a drastically different outcome, not the outcome that I received. And it was a very loud lesson for me that I was teaching my kids in that moment that they had to do something to be worthy and deserving of my love. And in fact, embedded within that lesson was that I only had enough for one of them. And that there was going to be an inferred competition from that day going forward. And I knew that I had to do better. But this is what we all learn. Whether our parents intended it to be that way or not, this is what we all learned. We learned it from our families and we learned it from our peers. We learned it from our teachers in school when we were always the ones who were given the highest awards. Or the ones who are always looked over. We learned this because this is the system that we grew up in, that love was conditional and that love meant always doing something to be worthy and deserving of it. Beyond that need for unconditional love is we have a need for safety, love, and then we lean into belonging, connection and belonging. This is a need for our survival. And sometimes that can look very physical, where we actually have that helping hand that picks us up off of the pavement when our knees are bleeding and our skates are spinning. But we also need connection in a very different way. There's an incredible psychologist who's also an author by the name of Sebastian Younger. And he wrote a book that I had read years ago called Tribes. Younger followed a group, actually many groups, to be honest with you, of soldiers to the Middle East during the war of the Middle East, the Gulf War. And what he was studying at that time is he was studying the psychological effects of war. And when we look specifically at depression, at manic depression and at PTSD, the interesting thing that he had realized in over 25 years of studying these soldiers, of being with them on the front lines, but then also watching them as they return home to their families, is that he recognized a lot of the symptoms of depression and PTSD did not show up when they were in battle. It didn't show up while they were waiting in the camps and sleeping shoulder to shoulder in their tents, on their cots. But in fact, that these effects, these suicide attempts as a result, and then ultimately the completed suicides, now those didn't show up there. In fact, they didn't show up until they came home. Until they came home and they were surrounded by their loved ones, where they had tons of support. They had psychological support. They had, you know, the perception of physical, mental, emotional safety around them. But what they realized is that it wasn't a support and a safety issue. It wasn't a love issue, that it was a connection and a belonging issue. And as much as their families and their friends and the others back home wanted to understand and to meet them where they were at, they simply couldn't. Why? Because they couldn't relate. It was a different layer of connection. They could not meet them in the trauma. They could not meet them in the pain because they simply did not carry that exact same level of relevance. But when they were in the trenches, shoulder to shoulder, you know, knee to knee, voice to voice, it was there that they found that ultimate connection. And so when we look today at everything that is happening in the world, at the insane increase of mental illness, of anxiety, of depression, and I believe, and especially being somebody who's been working in this industry for over 2 decades now, I strongly believe that it's not a matter of throwing more money and more resources at people. It's about helping and supporting other people to find those who really connect. And so if you are somebody in your life looking, how do I survive sexual abuse? How do I survive financial hardships and crisis and trauma? How do I survive the loss of a loved one? Is that it's not a matter of how do I find the right therapist? How do I buy myself something else to dig myself out of this? It's truly a matter of how do I find somebody else who's also been through this, who knows this and who understands this, who can also share with me, how did you get through this? What did you do? And it's there that we begin to not only find our way to survive through it, but we can actually begin to transcend that. That is what sits in the center of that psychological wheel. The last two needs that we have that help us and allow us to survive and get onto that edge and eventually, hopefully, dear God, to be able to thrive and to transcend are these needs to be seen and the needs to be heard. And in my opinion, when we're looking at middle essence, this is critical for us to know and to understand, because when we're talking about this need to be seen, is its need to be seen not for who I was, but for who I am and for who I am becoming. When we've lived long enough on this life, it means that we've done a lot of things. We've created a deep enough identity that it's almost as though you are an actor playing a role in a movie, that you've played that role for so long now that other people don't even know you as anybody else other than that role. I mean, dear God, look at so many of the actors that are out there who are so typecast and ingrained in one role that, you know, even if they try to step outside of that, it is next to impossible, because we, the audience, are so used to seeing somebody showing up in that way that it's, like I said, virtually impossible to see it as anything other than that. But that then pigeonholes, it keeps that person stuck. And so this is not unlike you in your life. This is not unlike somebody who at 45 years old is having a, I don't know, perceived midlife crisis, what really is just a spiritual crisis of the self. And it's saying, who am I? I am not what I have been led to believe or what I've been leading other people to believe. I have been playing this role for so long that in my heart, I know that this is not me, but I'm having a really difficult time digging myself out of this because it's the only way that others connect to me. It's the only way that others see me. And it's the only way that I've ever seen myself. So this midlife crisis, trying on new careers, trying on new relationships, trying on new things, right? New things, new stuff. Needing to move homes, cities, locations, new vehicles, all of these things that we try on in this middle age is ultimately a way of trying to step outside of this incredibly strong identity that has been built and to be able to get outside of that. And here's where a lot of the stress comes from. Here's where a lot of the anxiousness and the depression comes from. Is it's coming from the not wanting to be identified by that anymore, not wanting to be seen as that anymore, but not really knowing and understanding where to go from there. This is why I'm so excited that I'm doing this podcast here today, because then we get to have the conversation on the other side of this. Well, where do we go from here? This is the gift of middle essence, is it's not only a crisis of not knowing who I am, but it's now stepping into the void of the unknown. And it's a highly creative time where we get to create and to be and to do anything that we want to be. But before I get there, let's talk about this last psychological need for safety. Because safety comes when we can stand confidently and courageously in the knowing, right? That would be the knowing of being seen as who we are, feeling connected, feeling like we belong, feeling safe, and feeling unconditionally loved. But it is that last and final need of being heard and having our voices heard. Where this becomes difficult in our middle essence is because we are now beginning to bridge into a generation where, in our culture specifically, and I'm going to call this the Western culture, this more modern culture, is that we hold this, I'm just going to say, this generalized collective belief that as people begin to age, that their voices are no longer relevant. Look at what we have done for the majority of our elders and our seniors on this planet. We've stopped listening to them. They've retired. We have retired them. We put them into seniors' homes. We say, oh, don't listen to that old coots or whatever word we tend to use, some derogatory term. They're talking nonsense. They don't know what they're talking about anymore. They're irrelevant. They're old. They're dinosaurs. They're void. I don't know. My kids have all sorts of names for me now. And we don't listen to the wisdom that comes from experience. Maybe you're experiencing this yourself, but in order for us to feel safe enough, and what does safety feel like to you? This is survival. Survival for us to be able to move forward is to know that we confidently hold value. And it is definitely a value conversation. Oof. This is middle essence. This is phase one of life. Phase one of life is driven by our need for survival. So in our need for survival, we understand that we are human. This is part of waking up human, that there are rules that come with our humanity. And we learn to play by these rules. We learn to play by the rules set forth by our parents. We play by these rules set forth by our peers, by our teachers, and by society at large. And we play these rules for the first 10 years of our lives, the first 20, 30, the first 40 years of our lives. We play by these rules until we no longer can. And it's here that we are now somewhere around our 40th year of life. There's one of two things that start to happen. And the first thing that can happen is that things begin to change. All of the things that created safety for us in our lives, our key relationships, our relationships with our parents, with our siblings, with our friends, with our partners, partners being wives, husbands, otherwise our children, is that these things begin to change and it starts to rock this boat of safety. And if it's not just the things around us that change, the other thing that happens that thrusts us in to phase two is that you begin to change. You begin to change because you become bored playing the survival game. It feels monotonous. It feels unfulfilling. And it lacks a ton of meaning. And so either way, here we are. Things have changed or you have changed. And we call this midlife. This middle essence, our crisis, but also our time for a great spiritual awakening. Welcome to the midlife crisis, or again, as I like to call this is your spiritual awakening. And I get a lot of people who ask me about spiritual awakenings thinking that maybe it's one of those experiences where, you know, you're deep in meditation and all of a sudden the skies part and the angels come down and you get to meet all of your spirit guides and your loved ones who've transitioned and they gently take you by the hand. And lead you to the field of unicorns and rainbows and all of the other things. Whatever this insane expectation is that we have around what a spiritual awakening really is, I can promise you that for 99% of the population, it is absolutely not that. In fact, most spiritual awakenings, to my knowledge and in my own personal experience, looks a lot like going through a divorce, right? Navigating alcoholism, financial crisis or ruin, or having an absolute flood of finances available to you, but having absolutely no connection to yourself, to your partner, or to your children. Now, spiritual awakenings look a little bit more like knees on the bathroom floor, hand on the heart, or praying to God for the very first time in your entire life to help you, to not feel so anxious, so depressed, so shitty. This is a spiritual awakening. This is the moment where we are now half, if not three quarters of the way up the mountain. And the mountain, as I see it, is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When we look at that pyramid, when we have met all of those basic fundamental needs for survival, we have food in the fridge, right? We have fresh, clean drinking water every day. We have some version of a roof over top of our heads where we have created the identities and we play the roles where people like us and approve of us, like we're doing all of the right things. And it's that absolute moment where we feel like it's still not enough. It's not enough. It didn't get us there. It's not getting us there. And so whether the physical environment is crumbling outside you and around you, or you are literally feeling those towers crumbling inside of you, is that this is that greatest moment where we can now climb towards the peak. And that top rung of that pyramid, of that mountain, is now moving beyond the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the only place left that we have to go is into the spiritual. This is what Maslow calls self-realization or self-actualization. Not just our spiritual needs, but this is our need to self-actualize. Now, have you ever actually thought about what that means, right? Self-actualization. I mean, I've been very fortunate and very blessed that I have for many, many, many years followed in my own teachings, if you will, in my own spiritual path, is that I've been a devout follower of this wise yogic sage by the name of Paramahansa Yogananda. And Yogananda came to the US in the early 1900s, in 1920 to be exact. And he came from India, as you could probably guess. And his organization really followed what he would call the path of self-realization. In fact, his spiritual fellowship is known as the Self-Realization Fellowship. And it is entirely based on philosophy, which is wisdom and very practical tools around understanding the deep truth of who you are, why you're here, and what the purpose of all of these relationships and connections really are. And that is all of us. We are spiritual beings who are here having a human experience. But when we're only living down in the bottom of that pyramid, when we are in pure survival mode day by day, is that we are human beings who are grasping, looking for these very random and occasional spiritual experiences. But there does come these glimpses in our lives, if not one of these overwhelming moments in our life, which again, we can call it a midlife crisis or this middle essence spiritual crisis, where we actually are thrust outside of our bodies, outside of our lives, and we're looking almost as though we are observers, you know, on the other side of the windshield of the car, watching our lives go by, going, what the heck? How did I get here? How did I get here? And I get that because in a sense, I'm asking myself the exact same question right now. It's like, how did I get here? Maybe the only difference between me and you, or maybe where you're at now compared to where you were at even 5 years ago, is that when we walk more of a spiritual path and we're asking that question, how did I get here? We have a deeper understanding of who it is that's asking the question, right? This is where we start to lose some of the confusion around this. And it's like, how did I get here? How did I, as the spiritual being, who through my conscious choices and actions, and perhaps even some choices that I had made before even coming onto this planet, more soul choices, that this is what I want to learn, this is what I want to work through. Now I can start to put together all of the pieces bit by bit and say, okay, so then maybe it was necessary for me to choose this mother, to choose this father, to find this partner, to have this terrifying experience, to have these children, to not have these children, whatever your life has been. When we can start to put some of those pieces together from a soul perspective and realize that nothing is random, that the self is realizing that there is meaning and purpose in everything that has unfolded in our lives. Whether we know it or not, we begin to piece everything together and we recognize that there's no such thing as coincidence. There is no such thing as random, but in fact, that everything is a synchronicity, or what I like to call a serendipitous event, that is something that is taking place outside of myself based on a deeper desire inside of myself. And really, it's the desires that I wanted to talk to you guys about. Because when we get to this point and we begin to look outside of the window and we realize, oh my gosh, all of these things that I have done in my life, I've done to belong. I've done because I didn't feel worthy and deserving of love. And I felt that if I did this thing, that then that would equate to feeling a sense of worthiness around love for me. Right? All of these other things that I've done is so that people would recognize me, to applaud me, to appreciate me, to see me, to hear me, to do all of these things. And we actually realize at this point in our lives that I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do it because it no longer feels true. Or maybe in part that feels true, but what I did to allow me to survive for the first 40, 45, 50, 55 years of my life is that I recognize that this keeps me in this holding pattern that is not aligned with where I really want to be and with what my heart is truly desiring in this lifetime. So here's where we stand on a crossroads. Is because we're now at this critical moment where we really want to stop doing a lot of the things that we've been doing because it no longer fits. It no longer aligns with the who we are in the process of becoming, which is ultimately just more truly who we really are. And it requires us to stop doing certain things, right? It requires us to see some of the behaviors. Maybe for some of you, as this was for my husband, and then eventually for myself, this was to stop drinking. Because we realized that ultimately what alcohol was doing is that it was a vehicle, or it was a method of connection. And one of the hardest things, I watched him do this for years and years, especially in the industry that he was in, is that when he was making the choice not to drink, not to go, you know, for beers or drinks with the customers or with the guys, is that ultimately he wasn't invited out anymore, right? So when you cease the behavior, or when you cut the habit, is that this is also going to tug and pull on all of those necessary strings that are, you know, sitting in those bottom two rungs of that safety and survival pyramid, right? It's like, if I'm not included in this group, then how am I going to make it through? How am I going to survive? But as we begin to reach for that higher rung on that pyramid or on that ladder, as we move into self-realization and self-actualization, truly what is happening at this time is that we're realizing that the only person that we can really make happy and that we can really fulfill is ourselves. And as long as we are expending all of our energy and all of our resources, this includes time and money and, you know, all of the resources that we have available to making other people happy so that we can then in turn, if you're happy, then I'm happy, right? If I can make my husband happy, then whew, now I can relax and I can be happy. That takes a lot of energy. And so somewhere in this middlescent phase of our lives, we realize that this is too much energy and I need to cut out the middleman. If this at the end of the day is really just about me making me happy, that why can't I just bypass all of the others that I've now created this very interesting codependent relationship on? If I can just cut them out and walk that path of least resistance and do what is just going to make me happy. And if I can realize, or if I can actualize or understand what it is that makes me happy. Me as a soul, me as a spirit, me as the one who needs to feel deeply fulfilled from the moment that I wake up in the morning until the moment that I put my head on the pillow at the end of the night. If I'm happy, then those who truly love me and care about me, then they will be happy. It's a complete role reversal. But it's difficult. Why do so many people hesitate to doing this? Is because it requires us not only to let go of some of those habits and those behaviors, but with that, what ends up happening is we let go of certain relationships, right? We maybe let go of certain careers, the way that people identify to us. And that can feel difficult. I remember when I left, I was a personal trainer, an athletic conditioning person, coach, therapist for a really long time. And when I chose to leave that to go into mental health and into spiritual health, there was a lot of people who couldn't relate to me anymore because it was something that they didn't understand. They're like, well, I get what you're doing when you're in the gym or when you're in the studio because I can see you. But when you're telling me that, you know, you're supporting people with their spiritual health or their mental health, I don't really get that. So they didn't even know how to broach a conversation with me. And there still are many people in my life who are still sticking around and they're here and they still don't know how to do that. But there were people who simply faded out. And I'm not going to pretend that it wasn't hard for me to lose some of those relationships and connections. But I also recognize that as long as I kept bringing myself back into the familiar and the known just for the sake of connection and relevance, is that I was actually holding myself back from this higher experience of self-actualization. And, you know, sometimes when we look at people who are older, maybe they're in their 80s or their 90s, and we, I don't know, I say we, but maybe this is just me, but I'm going to guess that this might be you. But we look at them in their attitude in life, and it's a bit of like a, I don't give two F's kind of an attitude. It's like, I'm going to say what I want to say. I'm going to do what I want to do. Like me or don't like me, I don't care. And, you know, when I was 30, I envied, you know, my grandparents. I envied other seniors and elders for that attitude. And I always wanted to do that. But I thought, God, I'm not in the position where I can afford to piss that many people off or to lose that many relationships in my life. And I thought that at 30, I thought that at 40. And now as I come into my mid-40s and I'm, again, sitting in that bridge, I'm really recognizing this huge desire to step fully and completely into that and say what I need to say and to live my life the way that I want to live, the way that feels like I'm fulfilling a deeper mission. This is my sacred mission and my sacred duty, and that is why I've come here. And that if I'm 90 years old and I'm taking my last breath in this lifetime and I have not done any of that and I've only lived my entire life for the happiness and joy of others, I'm beginning to feel into what that is going to feel like. I'm beginning to feel already into the regret. And maybe you are too. And I keep saying it, and I'm going to say it again and again and again, is that I think that this time of really needing to take that deep breath because we are feeling ourselves letting go of that safety net so that we can jump into the next. And it feels a bit frightening. But there's also that deeper part when we are deep into the middle essence where it almost becomes undeniable. And it's like, I realize that I can't not do this anymore. So here's what I'm going to share with all of you. And it's something that I learned from one of my teachers, Deepak Chopra, probably 15 to 20 years ago, and I was not ready to hear that message when I was 25 or when I was 30, but I've shared this message with many of my students. I've shared this with my family members. I've shared this with my friends, and I'm really now understanding and leaning into this deeper than I ever have before, because this is that next net that you have been looking for. And it's the main question that we have to all ask ourselves that is going to give us the confidence and the courage to let go of what is familiar and what is safe and secure, and to jump into what is uncertain, what is unknown. But on a deeper level, we know that we have to do that to experience ultimate and lasting fulfillment in this life. And that is asking ourselves the question, is what is my primary purpose in being here on this planet? Another way of asking this is, what is my why? What is my why? What is the deepest spiritual experience that no matter how hard I try to distract myself from it, I try to numb it and I try to shut it down, is that this drive or this motivator for you, and I'm going to call it your spiritual driver, has been there since the moment that you took your very first breath in this lifetime. And it's going to be there until you take your very last breath in this lifetime. And there is nothing, my friend, that you can do that will ever get rid of this. You can try to, but you can't. And that I can promise you. But you know, or when you know what that is, and when you live your life from that place, is that everything else starts to not only make sense, but it starts to come together. And that then is the confident foundation that gives you everything that you need to keep going forward. This I can promise you. So what I had learned from Deepak is that there are 86 words in the English language, 86 words. And what he called these words is, he called these words experiences of spirit, meaning that your spirit or your soul that came into this planet, onto this earth plane, said, this is that motivator and that primary driver that is going to take me through everything. It's going to take me through these high moments. It's going to pull me through these low moments, but it's going to be that light at the end of the tunnel that keeps pulling me forward, because I'm going to keep seeking spirit. I'm going to keep seeking love, and I'm going to keep seeking the motivation to move forward through this channel or through this stream. And so there's 86 different words, and I'm going to give you an example of just a few of those words, but then I'm going to offer you the same gift that Deepak offered to all of us. And I'm going to put all 86 of these words in the show notes. Okay. So I'm going to encourage you that after this podcast is done, that you're going to go into the show notes wherever you're listening to this right now. And you're going to look over those 86 words. And my invitation to every single one of you listening is, you're going to put one hand onto your heart, or one hand onto your gut or your belly, wherever you feel energy in your body. And you're going to read through these words. And you're going to feel what every single one of these words feels like. And you're going to do it again and again and again. And maybe your first time through of those 86, there's going to feel like there's 10 that feel really loud for you. And you're like, maybe it's this one. Maybe it's this one. I'll give you an example. One could be adventure, because I know adventure is on that list. Another one could be solitude, because I know solitude is on the list. And I will tell you right now that mine is absolutely all day long, it is solitude. I am so driven by solitude. And it's very interesting in this life where I have been motivated to become a meditation teacher. And even though, of course, I believe 1,000% in the value of meditation, and I teach it and I share, you know, all of the benefits of meditation, it is what I need to evolve. And I recognize when I feel most out of alignment in my life, when I feel most stuck in my humanness, which is in my judgment and my shame and my guilt and my jealousy, is when I'm sitting in opposition to solitude. And that's just me. But for you, it could be adventure, right? Another word that's on there, I know for a fact, is wisdom. And maybe you're just a constant seeker of wisdom, and you have people in your life who are like, God, like, could you please stop taking courses? Could you please stop reading books? And you're like, I can't stop no matter how hard I try. You know, I want to sit back and take a year off to integrate. I can't. Like, the next thing pops up and I have to go after it. Or maybe you spent 12 years in post-secondary and, you know, you keep seeking over and over and over again. But when you understand what this is, and when we can really lean into it, especially and the gift of our middle essence years, is that we can begin to give less F's. I won't use the word right now because I'm not sure if that gets bleeped out, or if I think it's a whole bunch of extra, I don't know, warnings all over it. I don't know these rules yet, as much as I love that word. But I think of the book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F. And again, this is what really shows up for us in our middle essence years, is it's like, well, now I don't really care about that so much anymore, or I really do care about this. When you understand again what that driver is, is that this is what's going to get you past the hump of survival. And it's what's going to thrust you into the next phase of your life, into what it really means to thrive. Because this is now what you're not only chasing, it's what you're embracing. When you embrace all of your lessons through this lens, but when you also use this as the vehicle for your fulfillment, everything begins to change for you. That I can promise. And relationships make sense. It gives us the courage to be able to move away from certain relationships, from certain agreements, maybe that we have made that no longer fit for us, because we know that this is why I'm here. This is why I'm here, and this is what I'm going to do. And thank God. Thank God you are listening to this now, and you're not listening to this when you're 80 or 90 or maybe taking your last and final breath in this lifetime. And let's face it, for all of us, none of us know when that's going to be. None of us know when that's going to be. But I'm speaking very specifically to all of you who feel that you're sitting at a crossroads in your life right now, where you're old enough to know who you are not, but you're still young enough to be somewhat confused and in a place of curiosity around who am I really? And I'm so excited to be on this journey with all of you. Thank you for being here today. I know that as you continue to walk this path, this is the spiritual path, that it's not only you, yourself, your humanness and your soul that's going to benefit from it, but it's everybody else who's in your ripple. That's your partners, that's your children, that's your parents. That's all of those that get to float in this beautiful ocean with you. And so what the world needs is more of us to wake up and to understand who we are, to know why we're here, and to not waste another second of this most precious human and deeply soul-stirring life. And for that, again, I'm deeply grateful that you're here. Sending all of you so much love on this path. Namaste.